and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I'm your host this week, Becky Friedman, and I'm super excited because in the studio we've got Luke again from Same as Last Week. How you doing, Luke?
Doing good. You?
I'm doing great. And Eric, long time since you've been on the air with us. How are you, Eric?
I am doing well. How are you?
I, again, am great. It's a wonderful, a nice, beautiful day today. I think that we're going to have an awesome week weather-wise, and it's Earth Day. And so it's always something that, you know, atheists who celebrate our natural world can be very excited about. So, Eric, your background is actually in something a little bit related to Earth and environment and things like that. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
It is. So I teach at a local college. It's a water and wastewater technology program. It helps folks who are looking to practice working in the environmental technologies. So doing drinking water treatment or wastewater treatment and such.
So that sounds really, really glamorous, but at the base of it, you are working with poo, right?
Yeah, fundamentally. So I always tell folks that it's you have to have a bit of a sense of humor.
Okay, awesome. So as an atheist, do you ever get asked about how that interacts with your job or your work or anything like that?
Yeah, I think there is definitely overlaps. I try not to emphasize it too much, but it's something that, you know, if somebody were to ask, you can definitely find those relationships between the two.
Well, you know, I'm asking because actually this week, this past Thursday, was Ask an Atheist Day. Now, we are Ask an Atheist here. That's been our title of our show for a long time. This Ask an Atheist Day is actually a little bit different. This is something that's sponsored by the Secular Student Alliance, a great organization that helps students on college and high school and even middle school campuses organize as part of, sort of a associated student body thing, student clubs, same as, you know, anything like a gay straight alliance or an anime club or, you know, any particular club that you would have on a college campus or a high school campus. And the Secular Student Alliance Ask an Atheist Day usually is held twice a year, September and in April. And according to the SSA, it encourages the general public, particularly people of faith, to approach non-theists and ask questions about secular life. So this is particularly on college campuses, as you might see kids tabling out in, you know, in front of a student center, things like that, but also in social media. So, Eric, did you happen to see anyone out on your college campus on Thursday saying, hey, ask me anything, I'm an atheist?
You know, I'd like to say I had a chance to observe, but I wasn't actually on campus on Thursday. But I imagine that there were probably the atheists were being represented.
So we did actually find a lot of people in social media saying, hey, I'm an atheist, ask me whatever you want. So I actually asked what kind of questions did our atheist listeners get asked. So one of them comes from Scott from Michigan, who said, my atheist and non-atheist friends ask me stuff in jest, and in turn, I made silly replies. However, one friend did ask honest questions last night, and it exposed her to a boatload of critical thinking stuff. She asked if I had been brought up religious, then how I changed my mind, if my wife is the same as me, no, she's Catholic, and if God was witness at our marriage. And I got the chance to say, well, if God is omnipresent, he had to have been a witness, right? And overall, it was a productive conversation in that we were both civil, and I tried not to bog her down into deeper philosophical arguments that we're often exposed to. Have you guys, as atheists, ever gotten asked those kinds of things? Like, if you grew up religious, then why would you become an atheist? Or you know, oh, you must be an atheist just because you were never exposed to religion as a kid?
Well, I was raised Lutheran, so I was definitely exposed to religion as a child. On top of that, my dad's half the family is a variety of pastor type people, so there was some exposure for me, definitely.
And yet, even so, you became an atheist.
I did.
So it was not for want of never having heard the word, as many very religious people are wont to sometimes assume.
Right. No, the word really didn't seem plausible.
And so we also got some feedback from Jonathan from the Seattle area, who said, well, someone asked me about my being an atheist Sunday school teacher. That's kind of an interesting one. And I know Jonathan, and I know that he's a Sunday school teacher at a Unitarian Universalist congregation, which is one of the places that is most church-like. It is a church. It is a denomination that is most welcoming to people that happen to not believe in God. So that's kind of a neat, I don't know, a neat paradox that some people might assume, that you can't be involved in some weekly kind of instruction, even if it's called Sunday school at a church, if you're an atheist.
Yeah, I would, you know, for me, it would be trying to determine, you know, it's like if somebody asks a question of you as a, in your capacity as a Sunday school teacher, you know, it's like, well, what do you tell them? Is it going to come from essentially dogma, or is it going to come from your own, you know, personal beliefs?
Or it could be a question that you ask back of saying, what do you think? And really helping kids delve into that critical thinking part of it. And I think even if you are religious or if you're non-religious, that's a really excellent thing you can do to get any kind of student of yours to be able to delve into their own beliefs, not, as you said, Eric, come from your dogma or force your own personal beliefs upon young people trying to explore their faith or their non-faith or how they make sense of the world.
That's an interesting topic, especially as a parent, trying to get my kids to think critically and, you know, live their life in a way that's kind.
So you are raising a child right now who's kind of young and
right.
About the age that many kids would be going to something like Sunday school. Would you send your kid to a Sunday school taught by an atheist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't have any problem with that at all.
What if it was affiliated with a church? So in this case, the Unitarian Universalist Church.
It's a Unitarian Universalist, so I don't really see that as a major problem personally. So if it was like a Seventh-day Adventist, I'd probably have some issues.
Well, you'd probably be going to Saturday school at that point.
Right.
Given Seventh-day Adventist. Yeah. So we got one more response. David from Stockton writes, I answered questions about five or six really great questions, and all were respectful. Except for one guy who kept pressing and claiming that atheists were all hurtful and egotistical know-it-alls that hate everyone else. The post was readable only to my non-atheist friends, which made sure there wasn't any snark. So, fellow egotists that hate all humans and everyone, what do you make of this?
I'd like to know where this person is, this questioner is based out of, because, you know, in my experience with atheists, I've never encountered somebody where I would characterize the entire lot as that.
I've had, about 5 years ago, I'd just gone through a divorce and I was dating again. And while I didn't get asked any questions about my atheism in particular, I made sure I was upfront about it in the beginning. So everybody would know that, hey, I'm an atheist, and if this is going to be a problem in the relationship as we move along, we should probably deal with that now. And the strangest, or the one response that really sticks to my mind was, well, you're so nice, how could you be an atheist?
Oh, that one, that you have been fed these messages that atheists are egotistical, you know, humanity haters, and suddenly when you meet someone or when you see someone's profile even on a dating app and says, well, you're involved in your community, you're raising your kids to be, you know, kind human beings, you're involved in your work, you're doing all these things, wow, that really conflicts with what someone's been spoon-fed about atheists for their whole life.
Right.
Yep.
So did that relationship go anywhere?
No.
No.
My current one, my girlfriend for the past 3.5, almost 4 years now, she was raised Catholic, and that's been interesting, but we've had a lot of really good discussions about that stuff. And our kids at this point, between the two of us, we have three, are pretty much atheist at this point.
Would you be offended or upset if, you know, your kids or the kids that you were involved in co-parenting ended up joining a particular religion or becoming affiliated with a belief system?
That would, we'd have to have some discussion about that. She's effectively non-practicing, bordering on thoughts that are similar to mine at this point. But if she decided to go on to church or something like that, we'd have to talk about it. As I don't want my son to be raised in a very restrictive Christian church, and in the end I don't have a choice on what she does with her son, but I don't think he'd enjoy it very much either.
Yeah. So what happens if your kid grows up to be, you know, I don't know, like 12, 13 years old, the time that, you know, some teenagers, adolescents start wanting to rebel against their parents, and your kid happens to rebel by saying, that's, you know what, my dad raised me without religion, I'm going to go join a church. Would that be something that disappointing?
I don't know if I'd be disappointed about it, but I've thought about that as a possibility. It's one of the... So my children so far haven't really done too much rebelling against me other than not doing well in school. But as they get older, I'm especially the youngest one, I'm concerned how he's going to rebel because he hasn't hit that point yet. And if that's a topic I'm still thinking about how I'm going to respond to. It's a sticky one.
Well, if you're an atheist listener and you've had a child that's rebelled against your non-religious parenting by saying, I want to go to Sunday school or I want to, you know, observe the laws of a particular religion, go ahead and email us. You can email questions@atheist.tv or call and leave us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. That's a toll-free number throughout the whole U.S. And we'd love to hear if any of our listeners have had that happen to us. So, Luke, you said you'd be okay if, you know, your kid went to a Sunday school at a UU church, maybe taught by an atheist. What would you think if your child was subjected to Christian prayer on their entire 2-hour bus ride to school?
I'd have a bit of a problem with that. We'd be talking to some administrators on that one.
You know, in Minnesota, there were some other administrators and parents that did have a problem with that. A school bus driver has been yanked from his route for the second time in 4 years for coercing students into Christian prayer during their school bus rides. George Nathaniel, who is also a pastor at a Minneapolis area congregation, was fired from a Burnsville, Minnesota school in 2012 for the same action and is on leave from his job as a driver for a charter school that focuses on Russian language and culture. Nathaniel complained that his constitutional rights to free speech and free practice of religion have been violated, even though the transportation company he worked for explicitly gives drivers personal time to pray. Nathaniel admitted that his ultimate goal is to convert people to Christianity and says his mission includes bringing prayer to public schools. He believes that the parent complaints that led to his removal are actually retaliation for properly disciplining rude students by assigning seats on his bus. This is a publicly funded charter school contracting with a kid transportation company. He passed his background check, so he's good to work with kids in terms of safety, but he brings prayer into the bus rides.
So my thought here, my first thought was that so he's probably not Russian Orthodox, and this is a Russian language and culture school.
No, it's a publicly funded charter school, so I'm assuming that anyone would be able to go if you had an interest in that. But many of the kids are children of Russian immigrants or have Russian heritage, and so they're connecting with their heritage and their language, maintaining, you know, dual literacy and things like that. So, yeah, maybe Russian Orthodox might be a good guess for the majority of these families and kids.
Right. So my guess is he was trying to go something more evangelical, and the primary complaint would probably have been that he's trying to convert them from their religion to his religion.
Well, even if that was the case, even if he was doing Russian Orthodox prayers.
Still, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that the punishment was justified. It sounds like this bus driver had been spoken with before on this matter, and clearly he, you know, was informed that this wasn't according to the charter school's policy. And, you know, I think some people may be under the impression that charter schools play by a different set of rules than a typical, your conventional public school. And clearly this wasn't the case.
And the thing that's really egregious here to me is a guy complaining that his free practice and free speech, you know, free religious practice, rights are being violated. When you're transporting kids on public dollars in a public school setting, you're not allowed to exert your own religion onto them, especially when your company accommodates your own religious practice by giving you private time to pray. I just don't know how he feels this emboldened to make these kinds of claims. And I'm worried that in an atmosphere where we have many politicians and many very vocal, Christian media types that are saying religious freedom is under threat, your religious freedom stops at the point when it becomes either a government establishment or preferencing of religion, or when it becomes discrimination against others. And it worries me that he would feel so emboldened to do this, despite having been instructed 4 years ago that this is patently illegal.
Right. He's a representative of the government, whether he feels he is or not. And he has to follow those rules. He's not allowed to lead others in prayer.
Kind of worrisome in this case, but I think that overall an outcome can be very good when we make sure that even bus drivers, from football coaches to teachers to bus drivers, leave their religious practices out of the classroom, off the fields, and out of the school buses. This is Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Do give us a call at 844-SKEPTIC or email us questions at atheist.radio. Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I've got Eric and Luke in the studio with me, Becky Friedman, on this beautiful Earth Day. And, you know, one part of keeping our Earth healthy and clean is making sure that the waste that we create is properly treated. You know, I mean, Earth is made up of the enriched products. When we talk about Earth and our soil, right, that comes from, you know, the decomposers breaking things down. We all passed, you know, ninth grade biology class, I'm assuming, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least have followed up with it since then, if we weren't so keen on ninth grade biology or eighth grade, life science and things like that. And Eric, I'm really happy to have you here today with us, because there was quite the stinker of a story that really caught our attention. And this has to do with what some are calling the poop train. Tell us about this issue of the poop train.
Yeah. So this is a story that made the rounds through all kinds of outlets this past week. And it's kind of amusing, but also kind of annoying, I'm sure, for the folks that actually live in the affected community. So what had happened was this a train that was full of all of the residual waste products from New York City. Was basically stranded on the tracks in this small town for around 2 months. And
the small town still up in New York, or
a small town down in Alabama.
How the heck did the residual poop from New York City get all the way down to Alabama?
Right. So this is this is part of the logistics of treating wastewater, is that, you know, fundamentally, you can look at a wastewater treatment process as just a big solid separations process. So you're taking all the solids out of the waste and putting the water back into the receiving stream. But what to do about those solids? And so usually those get processed further. And then usually, kind of in the spirit of Earth Day, you know, generally they're put back into beneficial use. But because New York City produces so much, upwards of over 1,000 tons a day, basically they're filling up entire rail cars and they have nowhere to put it locally. And so they're shipping it all around the U.S., as far away as Colorado in some cases. But usually it ultimately finds its way into just a landfill. So
if it finds its way into a landfill, how the heck did it get stranded on these rail cars in Alabama?
So the problem that emerged down here in Alabama was that the community that which was kind of down the tracks from this one that is affected, they had issues with the odors that were being produced from the offloading of the solids as they were transported by truck up to the landfill. And so the county essentially filed a lawsuit. And so that's the reason why we had this train that was stranded.
So once you have that lawsuit filed, you have to stop any of the activities. And now these are activities that aren't particularly harmful. It's not like there was environmental harm being done, that these fumes, these odors were not, they weren't a health risk or anything like that.
Yeah. So the word that usually gets thrown out is nuisance. So it was nuisance odors. But just listening to some of the descriptions of the odors from these news stories, it sounds like they're people's day-to-day activities were somewhat affected by it.
flies were an issue.
Oh, I think it would be pretty egregious, though, actually, if you couldn't even, like, go outside without smelling, as we say, what is it, the solid waste?
Yeah, well, actually, with wastewater solids, the language that they like to say for properly treated waste are biosolids. And so that actually is a defined term. So the poop train, it's not entirely accurate, but I don't think biosolids train has quite the same ring.
No, not at all. Now, for a lot of us, we don't think super critically about what happens to our waste when we flush it down the toilet or we run the dishwasher and all that goes out. More locally, because we're not New York City, we're not producing these, 1,000 tons a day. What happens locally as we flush the toilet, take a shower, do our daily activities here?
Well, I'd like to say that every wastewater plant is unique. And so the decisions of how to manage the waste can also be unique as well. So in our area, a lot of the biosolids are treated to beneficial use standards. So that means they could either be land applied for agriculture, so put out onto farm fields or spread over forest land. The solids can also be processed to the point where they can be just bagged or distributed to people in the community for their backyard gardens or.
So wait, we're talking about me flushing the toilet, and then a series of months later, I can actually go to the plant and pick up the biosolids, as you say, and then put them back in my garden.
Right. So it's essentially it's something that is sustainable in that sense, where you essentially have this closed loop. So the basically the nutrients that are used to grow food, that are required to grow food, are something that can be captured and then put back into the soil. And so we can have sustainable agriculture. One of the things that people don't generally talk about, I'm sure a lot of atheists are familiar with Malthusian prophecies of, you know, starvation if we basically don't have enough food to feed our existing populations. And that's always, those prophecies have never come to pass. And so part of that is that, you know, we have improved agricultural practices. We have the ability to mine the air for nitrogen. So that's something that was discovered back in the late 1800s. Well, the one thing that we can't mine from air is, you know, nutrients like phosphorus. And those are things that actually do have to come from an actual mine. And like anything, mining is something that is extractive. The only way that we're going to be able to sustain our populations are if we can recover that nutrient. And one of the ways we can do that is actually through improved solid waste management of municipal wastewater.
So you're saying we actually have the option of mining, which is extractive in a lot of places, exploitative of the mine workers, and produces a lot of environmental degradation in those particular areas. So we could get phosphorus that way, but we can also get phosphorus from all of our biosolids?
Right. So phosphorus is something that is just a component of all human wastewater, and that's something that if it isn't treated, it just gets discharged back out into the environment, where it creates things like algal blooms, which affects water quality. There are ways that you can put the phosphorus back into the biosolids, or even separate the phosphorus from the biosolids and as pellets. So they would look pretty much indistinguishable from any other bagged fertilizer that you buy at your hardware store.
Mm. So how do we know if the stuff that we're getting at the hardware store or at the big box store in the garden section is from human poop or from down in a mine?
Well, this is one of the problems that if a wastewater plant actually does want to market their biosolids as a bagged product, one of the problems is that, you know, it's marketed as something as a fertilizer, but that the nutrient content can vary. And when you're buying essentially a chemical fertilizer, you want to know exactly what you're getting and how much of each things. And obviously, that's going to vary with something that's extracted from wastewater. So it's partially trying to inform your users about what the source of the wastewater or the source of the biosolids are. But I think most people are aware if they see something like around here in Tacoma, we have a Tagro and we have another product called SoundGrow, which is kind of similar to the Tagro. I don't know if many people are confusing that with something like Miracle-Gro, which actually is a genuine concern. Apparently the folks at Miracle-Gro were afraid that seeing biosolids, bagged biosolids marketed as SoundGrow would confuse them.
That they actually filed a lawsuit about that?
No, it was a trademark infringement.
Oh, okay.
And so the settlement that they was reached was that the folks who make SoundGro biosolids cannot sell that product in the same place where Miracle-Gro is also sold.
Now, back to the phosphorus. If I remember reading somewhere that the phosphorus mining was going to be an issue in the near future because we're running out of actual sources of that. Is that correct?
Well, right. I mean, anything that's extractive, essentially, it's not, yeah, you're going to run out at some point.
Right.
And if you actually look at where a lot of that phosphorus comes from, it's in Florida, where they essentially use hydraulic mining, which is really, really destructive to the environment.
Is that the same thing when we talk about fracking?
No. So this is where what they'll do is they'll use open pits and then use a pit gun, which basically is just like a fire hose, and then essentially make a slurry, then pump the slurry into a process that extracts the phosphorus from that. So it's, again, it's something that it's extractive, which means you're only going to be able to do that for so long. And, you know,
sounds like it requires a huge amount of water.
A lot of water, a lot of environmental degradation. And if you also, you know, think that, you know, what happens to that phosphorus? Well, if we don't recover it in our wastewater, it just gets discharged down our streams, where essentially it's just, you know, it basically can turn into sediment in rivers, which again can trigger algal blooms, oxygen deficiencies, dead fish.
The Hood Canal has a major problem with that right now.
Yep. So it's something that it, you know, phosphorus can either be something that's beneficial for agricultural use, but it can also be water quality. Something that can impair water quality if it isn't properly managed. And the way we manage it is through wastewater treatment. And that's, you know, getting back to New York City and how they manage their waste. And what's like, well, you know, perhaps future generations will go back and mine our landfills for phosphorus if they don't have any other sources.
And waste copper and all the other things we throw away.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's because you're saying that in, for instance, in Alabama, or you were referencing in Colorado, those go into landfills, just sort of like the water is gone and it's just the solids and they just have a space in their landfill where they put it.
Right. So again, that's usually not defined as beneficial use. You know, here in Washington, we're fortunate our state agencies do have a doctrine of beneficial reuse. And so most of our residual solids from wastewater treatment are being turned into something that is going back and turned into either agricultural products or something that can be distributed to their communities.
Right. In my town, they've started converting the methane into something they can burn to help run the plant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's it's something where, you know, these digesters, these processes that stabilize these solids, they produce gas as a byproduct, usually methane, which is basically, in other words, natural gas. So natural gas can be, you know, used for all kinds of things. You can compress it and run a vehicle on it. You can do all kinds of really neat things with natural gas, even turn it into electricity.
Now, methane is still a hydrocarbon, though. It is still a polluting agent, essentially, right?
Well, kind of. It depends on how you're auditing your carbon. And so the most greenhouse gas audits, when they're looking at carbon, they look at what the source of the carbon is. So did it come from something that's still in the carbon cycle? So in other words, that's the reason why, you know, when we breathe out carbon dioxide, that doesn't count against us and our greenhouse gas emissions.
You know, I have seen some politicians try and say that CO2 is just fine because humans make it and God made us this way, breathing CO2, and so CO2 should be fine. I mean, yeah. As atheists, it makes my blood boil and my eyes roll.
And of course, if it does become a problem, he'll fix it anyway.
Oh, the congressman?
No,
the particular politician?
God,
or his God? Oh, okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yep. So usually the problem is the carbon that's sequestered underground. That's usually where the problem arises. And so, you know, there are a lot of folks who say, you know, our national energy policy should, you know, revolve around, you know, extracting more of these sequestered or mineralized carbon deposits.
These are the dead dinosaurs in oil.
Yeah,
right?
Right. And so this is where, you know, the carbon that's basically, you know, in our biosphere can basically be reused. And so we're not adding more. We're just, you know, basically taking advantage of what's currently available.
Super interesting. And I think that there's always, you know, an angle on this when we say, do we as atheists, as rationalists, and as folks who aren't expecting to be saved by any particular supernatural God, you know, do we think critically about how we utilize things from our environment and how we reuse those things from our environment? You know, one of the things that we get taught, we're kind of roughly from the same generation where through all of our little PSAs and Sesame Streets and whatnot, we had the reuse, reduce, recycle, or reduce, reuse, recycle, right? As sort of that mantra. Yep. And we forget sometimes that that's actually a hierarchy. It's not pick one. And that when we cheerlead recycling efforts, that's really good. It's better than throwing away everything to begin with, but recycling is super energy intensive. And Luke, as you were saying, when you can capture the methane to power that recycling plant, essentially, if we're recycling biosolids and treating that, that's better than nothing. But reducing things, reducing our consumption in the first place, and reusing the things that are already created, would be way more beneficial than going through that recycling process.
And we're in a bit of a recycling crisis now because China used to import the majority of our recyclables, and they've decided they're not going to do that anymore. So waste management is having an issue trying to find where they're going to send all the recyclables.
I have heard a lot about that, specifically with regards to King County, and saying that a lot of those things that we put in the recycle bin, I think it was quoted as saying aspirational recycling. I aspire to have this thing recycled so I can feel good about myself, but maybe it's not recyclable. Maybe it's just contaminated my whole bin and this whole batch.
Right. And that's something that, you know, they always say that one of the hardest things to do is to change human behavior. You know, it's easy to sell a product as a solution, but trying to find a solution in altering behavior is always challenging. And one of the things that we've had in this particular area that's been worked really well is, you know, people have responded to recycling, and it might have been through those PSAs in the past. But, you know, when you have the stories saying that, you know, effectively your recycle bin is basically just solid waste, that isn't necessarily something that's helping to support that those behaviors.
And that's worrisome. Trying to find out what can be recycled, what you can put in the bin, making sure you get the right stuff in there. If you get the wrong thing or you don't rinse it off, suddenly the whole thing's just a second garbage can.
And it's really different. You know, a lot of us, you know, make our home in Tacoma, but maybe we work in King County or we work out in Pierce County, and there's different rules for those kinds of things. You know, can you put lids in the bin? Can you put single-use plastic bags, which are now banned in Tacoma, of course, for, you know, grocery bags, plastic bags and things like that. But can you put those in the recycling bin by itself? Can you put packing peanuts? Can you do the pizza box in your compost, or can it be recycled, or must it go in the general you know, garbage bin, things like that? So I think that it's something, as not just on Earth Day we think about, but as stewards of our planet and of our community, you know, how do we as people who don't think that God's going to save us, you know, how do we protect our own biome and our own community? And I think that that's something that's really important. Now, we know the importance of water quality, and I'm really thankful that in the United States, we've got, for the majority of communities, excellent sources of water, water waste treatment. We can, of course, absolutely lament the, you know, poisonings of water quality and things like that in places like Flint, where the folks still don't have clean water and have now lost the option to get bottled water from their government, which, of course, bottled water anyway is making use of plastic, one-time use plastic.
Right. And I mean, this kind of goes back to the original Earth Day. You know, this was, you know, just before the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972. You know, there was a big political push back then to do big things. And it's something that, you know, we still have big problems with our water quality. It's funny to go back and look at the goals of Clean Water Act. You know, the idea was in 10 years they were going to prevent all impaired water bodies and all sources of pollution going into waters.
Well, and so, speaking of aspirations, I mean, what was that, 40 years ago now?
Yeah, and it was, but it was transformative, because, you know, we'll tell folks that you know, prior to Clean Water Act, rivers were seen as as conveyances for waste. And so it kind of goes into the idea that, you know, if you had a creator and the creator put a river there for a purpose, and the purpose of the river was for humans to dump their waste into, well, then that's, you know, that was what was wrong with that.
I think what that speaks to is a very limited worldview where that river can take the thing away from me, or the air can take whatever I'm burning away from me. But as we know, we are one global community, and it's going to take it away from me and just bring it to someone else.
Somebody else gets to suffer with the consequences of our actions.
Exactly. So one of the things that this brings me to is a very strange, somewhat related, but very strange story about naturopaths and homeopaths. So, because as we look at being one global community, and we say, hey, water can take things away from me, the air can just take those pollutants and contaminants away from me, we think, where does it go? One of those places might be Haiti. And Haiti, we know, has suffered economically and environmentally from things like the earthquake, and has a very difficult time with things like wastewater treatment. And we still have places in Haiti that have, you know, cholera outbreaks every so often, which, of course, is, you know, fueled by lack of access to clean water or treated water. And it brought me to this troubling story. A naturopathic doctor from Portland, Maine, recently traveled to Haiti with the group Homeopaths Without Borders to treat patients and train local doctors in the use of acute care homeopathy. Deborah Krasner believes in the body's ability to heal itself with natural remedies as opposed to using drugs or surgery. Some of the treatments she teaches and employs include therapeutic nutrition, lifestyle counseling, herbal medicine, homeopathy, and vitamin and mineral supplementation. Part of the mission of Homeopaths Without Borders is to provide homeopathic care and healing in emergency situations, and the organization has provided crisis relief in many South and Central American countries. So you've got a water quality crisis, and the best thing that you can think of is to say, why don't you have a homeopathic remedy to treat what might be your oncoming cholera? Please educate us about this one, Eric.
Well, this is the sad thing is that, you know, Haiti being such a poor country and the U.S. Being such a wealthy country, you know, it wouldn't take a lot to fix Haiti's problems. Basically, you know, cholera is a symptom of a lack of infrastructure. So, you know, the things that we take for granted here in the U.S., we have, you know, piped public drinking water systems, and we have we manage our wastes, we manage our municipal solid waste, and as well our wastewater. You know, it's, you know, to prevent a cholera outbreak really just requires maybe a little bit of chlorine, but I don't think homeopathy or remedies that go along of the lines of that that are basically not evidence based, but yet, you know, somebody is committing resources to essentially practice quackery.
In a country that is horribly disadvantaged.
Right. It's, you know, this is something that, you know, it doesn't take much. It wouldn't take much. You know, even after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti where they did have cholera, essentially the public health response to that locally was to essentially provide small vials of hypochlorite or bleach. So basically people would gather their water and they were told to add a little bit of bleach before they drank that water. And that's, it may sound basic, but that's really all you need to.
Was that a pun now? I mean, yeah. Is this on the pH scale here?
Right. I try to avoid that. But no, that's, it is something that it doesn't take much. If you look at what the cost of chlorine, it's next to nothing.
You know, one thing that is a good sign for this is that you have something that sounds kind of on its surface very silly, Homeopaths Without Borders, and sounds on its a little bit deeper, very scary, which is, you know, acute care homeopathy. You know, you've got a burst appendix and I'm going to try and treat you with some herbs and natural remedies. I mean, when you might become septic, that's scary. But one good angle to this is that we do have the similarly named organizations, Médecins Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders. And the fact that Doctors Without Borders would exclude homeopaths, it really brings to mind this sense of security that we don't have these kinds of quack remedies that are being offered to people in really, you know, grave situations. I think that we're not done with this topic yet of naturopaths and homeopathy, though. So stay tuned at Ask an Atheist, where we might get into something that might sound a little bit less, I don't even know, a little bit less sensical than even acute care homeopathy.
Has Ngatwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster Ngatwe Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an In God We Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I'm hosting today. My name is Becky Friedman, and I've got Eric and Luke with me in the studio. And we were just examining the complexity of having something like homeopathy or naturopathy being used to treat things that can be treated and by many accounts should be treated with conventional evidence-based medicine or with evidence-based practices of, you know, treating your water appropriately to make sure that it is drinkable and isn't going to be causing, you know, harm to the people who consume it. Now, we've got something that is slightly even more egregious than this, at least at its output. And this has to do with actually up in Victoria, I believe. And it's about a Canadian homeopath based in Victoria who has revealed that she treated a four-year-old boy with a concoction derived from the saliva of a rabid dog. The child, who had been bitten by a dog as a toddler, was aggressive towards peers, drawn to, according to the mother, dark and evil things. He had a fear of wolves that led to extreme bedtime difficulties, and during the daytime, the boy would pretend at being a puppy. Practitioner Anke Zimmerman concluded that the long-heeled animal bite, along with a supposed epigenetic predisposition thanks to his father's childhood history of being bitten by dogs, had caused a, quote, slightly rabies-flavored dog state in the boy. As the child grew over several months, his behavioral symptoms improved, causing Ms. Zimmerman to assert that her cure, which is one of 8,500 homeopathic treatments approved by the Canadian health system, had worked. Where do we even begin with this, gentlemen?
So she gave the kid the rabies virus.
She didn't give the kid the rabies virus. Here's one of the things that we got to understand about homeopathy, and maybe Eric, as a water expert, right, you can help us with this. I guess this product that's marketed as Licinum or Hydrophobium is prepared actually by a UK organization. Homeopathy seems to be very, very popular in the United Kingdom. And it comes from an extract of the rabies virus. But how does that homeopathic concoction actually come to be?
You know, it's my understanding that they look at dilution as being the way of diluting the thing that causes the illness in the first place. So the like cures like, as is put, you know. So the idea of, you know, you're going to have whatever is the source of the infectious disease, be it the, you know, rabies or whatnot. If you just dilute it enough to the point where it actually becomes, you know, essentially water, and that the water, as I understand it, it's supposed to retain a memory.
Memory or energies, something like that?
In all of your scientific training and in all of your engineering background, have you ever heard of water retaining a memory of anything?
You know, I've never encountered that. It's not usually not something that we try to do in drinking water treatment. So it is, it's kind of a curious explanation for something that which probably doesn't actually do anything.
So probably this was watered down to the point where even the suggestion of an active viral component was not even present. So we've got a little bit less to worry about there.
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think the people who are performing these dilutions really, you know, are thinking about, you know, how many plaque-forming units they're actually, viruses they're actually diluting it down to. And I think the concern is that even if it is, you know, diluted, that they, you know, it could actually cause harm, if not by through the transmission of the disease, but it could be also through something else that may survive the dilution process.
Now, in terms of causing harm, you have a child who's troubled in some way, behaviorally and things like that. Now, Luke, your kiddo, he's gone through different phases, I'm certain, right? Where, you know, you have some things that are kind of a little bit annoying and you gotta, you know, sort of indulge or set boundaries, and then he grows out of it, right?
Right. He used to like potatoes. Now he won't eat them. And
okay.
I'm hoping that's just a phase.
Okay. So, you know, this little one had nightmares. That's not completely,
it's-
you know...
much more extreme than my situation.
And so, well, he had nightmares, and maybe your kiddo didn't, and he found bedtime just fine. But that's a normal thing that sometimes toddlers go through.
Absolutely.
And even if it's not normal for this child, I think that perhaps doing something other than treating with some you know, sugar pills or sugar water tinctures might be called for. And then to assert that after several months the symptoms don't go away but improve. I mean, that could just be a child going through natural development.
Right. It's a developmental stage of childhood to change over time. They do that.
So here's some of the things that's also really worrisome is that in Canada, you actually have Health Canada, which is their you know, medical system, that actually has a lot of these things approved in terms of treatments. In the United States, we have through some of our health insurance programs, things that are not evidence-based that, you know, might be approved on your insurance, which might be, you know, a state insurance. It might be any of those kinds of things. So we actually have Victoria's provincial health minister, Dr. Bonnie Henry, who's investigating getting this product and treatment revoked or restricted from Health Canada's approved list. But as we noted, this is just one of over 8,500 treatments or products that are being approved. And I think that it's very interesting to look at this. And in other Commonwealth nations, like in the UK, there has been a real, you know, sort of big to-do, a hullabaloo over getting homeopathy off the NHS, off the National Health System, by saying this isn't part of health. This is part of quackery.
I was just thinking that. Didn't they recently remove all of that stuff from their health system?
Yeah, I believe so. If we've got some British listeners and you want to correct us on this or add your own input, feel free to email us at questions@atheist.radio. But, you know, you could say if it's just sugar water, if it's diluted, if really this solution didn't actually, you know, contain any part of the rabies virus, what's the harm in giving it to a kid anyway if they're just going to grow out of it anyway? It might be like a little bit of a placebo, like putting a Band-Aid on something when you're not really hurt.
I would think that a sugar pill placebo would probably cost a lot less than what these homeopathic treatments are costing.
Absolutely.
And again, it's harm because these are, you know, in many cases public health systems, and so, you know, there's always going to be finite resources, and you want those resources to be used in an efficient and appropriate manner. And, you know, just, you know, essentially trying to seed quackery isn't necessarily the best use of those resources. The other downside is that, you know, these things could actually be cause harm, in the sense that if somebody believes them to be being effective treatment, that may have the effect of these people may not actually seek effective treatment.
So if you did actually have a child that was pretending at being a puppy, was having a hard time reaching their developmental milestones, the nightmares and the bedtime, you know, terrors would, you know, be affecting their sleep. If the parent were to forego treatment that could be effective, you could be damaging this particular child.
Yeah, that's definitely something that could be a serious problem.
Now, there was one other really weird aspect to this, because it seems really, really strange and alarming to have this medication or this treatment derived from the rabies virus. But I looked into it a little bit, and, you know, Eric, you're a pet owner. And presumably you have you've sought veterinary care for your animals,
right?
You know, on occasion. I'm a pet owner. You know, I bring my pets for, you know, preventative and for, you know, acute care and things like that. Well, this hydrophobia seems to be a common homeopathic remedy in the veterinary business, which seems very, very weird to me. And I've gone to the vets and they say, would you like, you know, a pamphlet on our complimentary something or other? And I'm like, maybe this isn't the vet clinic for me. It turns out that this thing is actually marketed to pet owners for when they think that giving the rabies vaccine to their dogs or their cats would create a behavioral change in their pets. Give the pet the homeopathic pill and the rabies vaccine won't affect them, but they'll still be cured against rabies.
There's a movement, anti-vaccine movement involving pets now, and this is probably a part of that. That's kind of scary.
It's startling.
No, and this is something that, you know, I'm not sure if why a pet owner would choose this. I guess it's not that far of a leap to say, you know, if it's good for your pet, maybe it's also good for your child. And I think this is where, you know, this case in Canada started to emerge, where I think there was a bit of surprise that there was somebody who practiced this on an actual human.
Well, and the other thing that it's used for, which is so weird, you know, it's called hydrophobium or lisenum. And as part of the rabies virus, as it progresses, you actually become averse to water. Some animals, including humans, right, really don't want to take in any water and they get dehydrated. This is used for treating pets who don't like their bath time, right? If you have a dog who's scared of water and doesn't want to go swimming, if you've got a black lab that won't, you know, jump into the lake or something like that, or a pet that hates bath time, just give them a little bit of the rabies thing. And since rabies makes you afraid of water, if you give them the homeopathic version of it, they'll love water all of a sudden. I mean, the kind of mental loops that you have to go through to make these kinds of assumptions is just bizarre and antithetical to, you know, the scientific process, to the investigative process, and to basic logic.
But it also, you know, you have to look at preys on people's vulnerabilities. So if, you know, you happen to be the parents of the 4-year-old child who's behaving like a rabid dog or something like that, or maybe having a dog or a cat that's behaving some sort of behavioral abnormality, and it may be that suddenly you're vulnerable to, you know, those claims.
I think that we can think of nothing more vulnerable, no more vulnerable state than having an infant child who is sick. And this brings us to our last homeopathic story, at least. And this is from Australia, actually. And this is an Australian naturopathic practitioner who believes that fasting cures illnesses will spend more than half a year in jail for the grossly negligent role she played in the near death of an infant that suffered from eczema. Marilyn Bodnar had placed the child's mother on an extreme diet of raw produce and seeds, and eventually only watermelon and water, while advising that the baby be exclusively breastfed. The 8-month-old was admitted to the hospital after 3 months of this diet, weighing only 14 pounds and suffering dehydration, fever, vomiting, a staph infection, and now at 3 years old requires monitoring for developmental delays and other health issues. Here is a perfect example of what is the harm. When you have something that is out of the norm and isn't tested, that doesn't have peer review, that doesn't have outside monitoring to check to see what you're doing, you run the risk of nearly killing a child. And I think that that in this case, it's really egregious. You know, when you have this quackery saying that, you know, opposed to everything that we know about biology, physiology, and medical science, you must fast in order to flush out these hypothetical pretend toxins. You know, that's causing a fairly common, which can be mild to moderate or severe, skin disorder in babies.
Should we start doing bloodlettings as well?
trepanation?
Oh,
what do you
yeah,
think?
That,
So from the sad things to maybe a little bit of the light, since we do have our water expert, we have an email, actually a Facebook comment from Megan from Texas. And Megan writes, wondering, somewhat tongue-in-cheek perhaps, what kind of wine did Jesus turn the water into? White? Red? Could he change the alcohol content?
Wow, that's an interesting one. You know, that's... For me, what could Jesus turn water into? What kind of wine? I'm not sure if there's anywhere in the Bible that discusses Jesus's wine preferences or his tasting notes.
Now, were you raised religious? Because maybe you just haven't heard the good word.
Oh, no, I wasn't raised religious, but specifically, what would Jesus drink? And or what would Jesus?
Oh, that's what the D stands for in that that little WWJD.
<Yeah. laughs> I'd like to think that maybe Jesus would have liked something light and crisp and refreshing, like maybe a rosé. But if you're looking at maybe what did they have in that period at that space and time. You know, there's a fascinating history of winemaking and going back to, you know, thousands of years, almost as old as civilization. It turns out one of the issues that they had back in the biblical times was trying to keep the alcohol in the wine. So in other words, trying to keep the bacteria and the air out. And so it turns out a lot of the wine was spiked with resins and other things to inhibit bacterial growth. And so there might have been a bit of a piney aftertaste to the wine that Jesus would have made.
But, so this is to prevent it from vinegarizing, right?
Right, right. Okay. So but I'm not sure maybe if Jesus had the power to maybe inhibit those bacteria, maybe that his followers wouldn't have had the pine residue.
So I'm going to make some assumptions here. International trade wasn't at its height at that time period. So regionally, the Middle East is a poor wine producing area, so the grapes are usually would have been subpar. On top of that, they didn't know that yeast was what you used to ferment wine, so oftentimes the alcohol content would be lower. And again, I'm going to make an assumption here. I'm guessing that they probably would have used the whole grapes, and it probably would have been red.
Kind of really tannicky, and
yes,
you know, from all of those grapes. Well, Megan, if you've got an idea about what kind of wine Jesus might have turned that water into, or if any of our listeners do, go ahead and email us at questions@atheist.radio or tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. Give us a call, voicemail 844-SKEPTIC. This has been your hour of Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, but I'm hosting this week, Becky Friedman, and I'm so glad to have Luke and Eric having been in the studio with me. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week. Happy Earth Day.